Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 119. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, performers unions. Equity is the biggest performers union. It is there to help the rights of performers in all areas of the arts. I got on two guests this week, and I get them to fully introduce themselves at the start of the podcast. But basically, Michael Day, who is the London Variety Officer, and Louise Granger, who is in charge of marketing events and training at Equity, came on to discuss the pros and cons of joining, their role within the Me Too movement, the areas they want to improve on, the way they communicate with comedians, what they offer, what they don't offer, and what you get for your membership money, and so much more. If you're a performer who isn't a member of Equity, or you're a performer who is thinking about joining Equity, or even just someone who's a professional who's thinking, you know what, I'm a bit annoyed about how some promoters don't pay on time, or I'm owed quite a lot of money from that booker. I think I need to get some representation to help me out with that. These are the people that do that. And here's how, essentially. I learnt loads from it. I've been an Equity member for a number of years now, and it's one of the most useful things I have, really, as I use it largely for the insurance. I can't remember what I pay a year, it's £100-something a year, and that covers me for all the festivals I do throughout the year. This year, I'm doing, 12, 15 festivals, and a load of other shows that I'm doing separate from them, but just around the country. Links in the show notes if you want to come and see my new show, Every Room Becomes a Panic Room When You Overthink Enough. It's going to be at the Edinburgh Festival. I really like Equity. I really think they do a good job. I think they have areas to improve on, and we do cover that. And I really enjoyed learning more about what I'm paying for within a year. So I hope you get a lot out of this as well. If you're new here, please don't forget to hit that subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do join the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. But for now, this is Michael Day and Louise Granger.
So I'm Michael Day. I'm the London Variety Organiser is my job title. So I have national responsibilities for the area within the union called Variety, Circus and Entertainment. That includes comedians. It includes lots of other things. Circus, jugglers, street performers, stilt walkers, burlesque, anything like that. So within the union there's probably about 10,000 members that do that work. The London part of my job title is that I do legal casework within London and visit workplaces within London. So that's about right. Don't need anything more than that at the moment?
No, that's everything.
Okay, well, I'm Louise Granger and I look after marketing events, training and services for members. So I don't do the industrial negotiation stuff, but I do deal with things like members' general advice or some of our specific services around training or some of our things around like mental health, careers advice services, job information service, anything that is service oriented rather than what we would call industrial, which is when you're into rates of pay, disputes about contracts, that kind of thing. That would be Mike's side of it.
Cool. So I think the best place probably to start is what Equity specifically does for comedians and what they don't do for comedians.
Okay. So I'll start with that then. Equity's always represented comedians, but it's only really recently that we've got a group which we call our Comedians Network, which we can engage with more closely and look at their issues more closely. So that was founded in 2015, and it's partly on a Facebook group, and there's monthly meetings of a core group, and that's us looking at the issues that are going on in comedy at the moment. On a sort of individual level, we do legal cases for people when they've been cancelled, when they've not been paid. And we provide, as part of membership, public liability insurance, which is something that comedians do generally need because they're working in an environment where they're doing their own act. And if their mic comes off and hits a member of the audience, they could be sued and have to pay damages. So there's those sorts of things.
I was going to ask a quick question that came off of that then.
Yeah.
A lot of performers, when a gig's cancelled, and say, for example, they've made travel preparations or hotels in some cases to stay overnight, are slightly worried about reporting that, even though they are meant to be compensated, because they might get blacklisted or not booked again. How does that work within Equity?
Well, blacklisting isn't legal for a start, but it's true that comedians do feel vulnerable about making a fuss about things. So I think a lot of them don't do it because they think they won't get another job from that promoter again. And possibly that there's some truth in that with some promoters anyway. But they are entitled to it legally. And if they can come and talk to us in the first instance, and we can help them make a decision as to whether they want to go forward with it or not. Sometimes they don't want to work for that promoter again anyway, and they'd rather just have their money. They don't want to be messed around again. So I mean, we do get quite a lot of legal casework for comedians for those circumstances. So yes, I would say to anybody, do talk to us. We won't necessarily take it further if you don't want us to, and it might ultimately be a commercial decision as to whether you want to pursue it or not.
I suppose, are you keeping track of, say for example, a promoter repeatedly is cancelling things?
Yes, we would have a record of every claim made. So if we know it's happening a lot, then we could be saying to people, look, it's time to do something now. And you've got 6 years to do it as well, really. That's the thing about contract law. You don't have to do it straight away. So you could save it up until you've fallen out with that person completely and then take it up if you wanted to.
Didn't know that. So it's like a small claims court type thing. But
yes, that's right. That's ultimately where we take it if we can't get anywhere through negotiation.
Yeah, so I just add on. So if you don't feel strong enough to deal with it at that time, or you feel you're in a more vulnerable position, if it, as Mike says, you want to hold on to that, but keep all the information about it, keep the emails, keep the documentation and so on and so forth, then when you are perhaps more established or more confident in the industry or whatever, then, you know, as long as it's within 6 years.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. What misconceptions do people have about what you do? Like, what things do people think you do that you don't actually do?
Oh, can I do our favourite one? Our favourite one is Equity should pass a law.
Oh, okay.
We can't actually pass laws. We lobby, right. We campaign, we put pressure on, we take issues about arts generally and specific performer groups or sectors to government. We influence, we do all of that, but we can't actually pass a law. And that's a very common one that we hear.
Another thing we get is someone has stolen my joke, somebody's ripping off my material. That's right. Quite a common thing. I think a lot of the comedians out there on the circuit are kind of quite honest, decent people and don't want to breach someone else's copyright or they want to come up with their own stuff. They don't want to rip off someone else's. But a joke can be covered by copyright. It has to be original and it has to be significant enough to qualify for copyright coverage. But a lot of the time, a joke is just something that has been passed around and it's too insignificant to be covered. So a longer sort of anecdote type story might qualify because it has to be, like an artistic work. And knock knock, who's there, etc., isn't an artistic work, and it's probably already being passed around, playgrounds and clubs and things already anyway. So it has to be your original work and it has to be significant enough. But Equity don't cover copyright claims. If we did, we wouldn't be doing anything else. That's the reality of it. We get asked about that a lot. Okay. So we can advise people, but we can't, you know, pursue a claim through the intellectual property court. So
yeah, because you guys have legal service providings that you can do for people. So what is that specifically? Is that like you have lawyers in house, or you just have contacts with people that are specific to arts lawyering?
Well, we use lawyers if we need to, but staff are sufficiently trained to use small claims procedures. If we need personal injury, so if somebody's been injured and it's actually the fault of their employer, then we pass that on to a firm of personal injury lawyers that we use.
Okay.
But we do the contract claims, and we do employment tribunal type claims, but not for comedians. They don't tend to fit into the employment tribunal scenario.
So with those cases, it tends to be dealt with before you would get into a formal tribunal or a formal court case. We tend to just deal with them on a hello, we're equity, let's talk to you, Mr. Promoter, Mr. Employer, Mrs. Promoter, Mrs. Employer, or whatever, and just get this sorted out.
This all makes sense then. So, because in 2017 we were talking about how you guys tried to formalise contracts a bit more for clubs, and it makes sense why you would want those to be standardised if that's a lot of the work you guys often have to come across.
That's right.
Especially if it's because you've got that contract, you know, let me get the name of it, I don't want to get it wrong. The comedian standard contract, the 3-page thing. So I suppose if a lot of promoters were using that, you at a glance could tell if we've got a case, which makes everything a lot easier at your end as well.
It does, because otherwise we have to look through a chain of correspondence, which might be partly by text message, partly by email, partly on Facebook, and then piece it all together and work out if a contract was actually made. So what the promoters do tend to do, though, in terms of the contract, is rather than actually physically use that template for every single booking, they agree to sign up to the terms and conditions and then just complete the deal using email. So that tends to be an easier way for promoters to effectively use the contract without actually going through all the admin of filling in a form every time. And that works fine for us as well.
Perhaps we should explain a bit how it came about. Well, it wasn't sort of you, me and anybody else sitting here just going, we think we should do this. It was devised and worked on and collaborated on with our comedian network. So, you know, professional comedians absolutely influence what went into it. And because that's how we work. We don't just sit there and go, you must. We try and work more collaboratively with the relevant artists, relevant members.
So how is that going? How many clubs are using it at the moment? How are you policing that clubs have started to enforce it?
It's a fair number. It's not as high as we want it to be. It's more in the sort of 25 to 30 sort of area at the moment. And we haven't had any issues raised from anybody booked by any of those venues. So it's basically the good guys using it, really. The casework I am dealing with wasn't done on those standard forms. But I suppose there's an opportunity that once the claim's been resolved with those ones, we can go back to them and say it would be so much easier. We could have avoided all this if you'd used the contract. But we would have to ask our group whether they thought that the promoter or club was a good one for us to go into an agreement with, whether they're going to honour it or whether they're just going to sign up to it for their own benefits and then not really stick to it.
Do you have like a promoter network then?
Some of the Comedians Network people are promoters. I think it's just the way the industry is. People do both, don't they, a lot. So I think it's largely those that are artists as well as promoters that are using it. So
it's always interesting that there's fear about doing something properly, you know, fear about having a framework, having a contract, because Equity, is our 90th anniversary this year, and when performers got together because they were just fed up of being abused and messed about and contracted, destroyed, and they decided to make a stand and make a difference. And so 90 years of experience, obviously not personally, but of introducing structure and frameworks into sectors that didn't have them or weren't particularly keen on that idea, has shown that actually over time those sectors then do start embracing that, because It saves time, it saves money, it saves grief, it saves all sorts of upset, to be razzed gone forever, just to have a framework to work to. Mm. And it is that simple, really. Everybody knows where they stand and what they're doing.
But also, do you, on the flip side of that, as someone in within the circuit, I think it's not... I think probably with some people it is a fear of changing it or even going with something so formalised, because I think... I mean, I sometimes compare the circuit a bit to like Fight Club, because we're kind of all sort of working in the evening and then we see each other in the day and we sort of go, but we don't talk about the gig, you know? And I suppose it's sort of this... sort of the system's always kind of work, not properly, but it's kind of, so I feel like everyone's a bit like, well, if it's not fully broken yet, why try and patch it, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
no, that does make sense. But then it is comedians who are coming to us saying, we need something, we want something, because I think, you know, it is a sector, an industry that is just changed so quickly and continues to change more and more quickly, you know, and I think there is sort of an internal feeling that, that now it's at a point of needing something a little bit more professionalised, perhaps, so that people do know that if they've driven all afternoon to get to a gig, that that gig is actually happening.
Yeah.
And what happens if when they get there and they're told it's not, you know, what are their rights, what can they do, and to have confidence around that. And I think some of that framework structure is, you know, it's coming up from the grassroots that this is what's wanted.
Well, what about the other way around? If I was a promoter and I had a comedian who cancelled and I was a member of Equity and they signed that contract, could I take them for a fee?
Yeah, well, the thing is about if you're claiming damages off somebody, you have to have actually suffered a financial loss. So the promoters are in a bit of a position where there's is a buyer's market. If someone lets them down fairly late on, they can still get someone in to cover.
Right.
And therefore, their financial loss is making that phone call or maybe paying that person a £10 more than they might have had to pay the original person or something like that. So it's not really going to be worth their while in pursuing that comedian for that £10 difference or whatever they'd be legally entitled to. But yes, they would be entitled to, if it's a breach of contract, they would be entitled to take action if they suffered a financial loss. Usually they don't, because they're, say if it was a big name that pulled out and they had to refund loads and loads of tickets and all that sort of thing, then there would probably be much more of a financial loss there, and they might be inclined to do something about it. In practice, what most do is think, oh, well, I'll think twice before booking that person again if they think they've let them down for a not very good reason. Yeah, I mean, if it was a good reason, they might well have sympathy. If it's because they're getting 50 quid more for performing somewhere else, then they might not be so sympathetic.
Yeah, it's very much a seesaw thing, because at a certain level, the promoter has all the control, and then at a certain point when you're famous enough, you kind of have the control, because they might not want to pursue it as well, because they'll be like, well, I have lost out, but if they come back, I don't want to lose that business.
That's right. So there is some give and take, and there's nothing wrong with there being give and take if it's fair. Do you know what I mean? You know, if it's always the artist that's suffering, then it's not fair.
Yeah, it's a very abstract thing, because fairness is sort of very subjective to the situation.
Yes.
And that's kind of where you guys come in, I suppose.
Yeah, I think part of it is because the fees aren't massively high, are they? So if someone's only being paid £50, it's easier to pull out of than if they're in a, you know, 6 month run in the West End being paid £2,000 a week or something. It's like, I mean, a contract's still a contract.
Yeah.
But, you know, the low fees are probably a factor in thinking why somebody might not want, well, might choose not to do a job. You know, it's about how valuable that is to them.
If they get a better offer.
Yeah, because it depends on...
Which is quite often what happens, you know.
It depends on the club. So, like, if you're doing a weekend club, you could be between, like, £150, £250 for the set. And so, to my mind, that would equate to, say, you're doing £2,000 a week or whatever.
Yeah.
It would equate to roughly the same thing, but just for
daily
one
rate,
night.
Right, yeah.
So it's interesting that maybe certain promoters, if the fees are so low, and if you're a comedian and your pay is so low, you're like, well, what am I going to... Like, why would I benefit from this?
Yeah. So those sort of paid gigs at that rate are, you know, more likely to be honoured, aren't they, basically? If it's £150, £200, you're much more likely to want to honour that, whatever. That's, you know, it's going to be for somebody who's a promoter who's a higher reputation, or a club that's a higher reputation, that you wouldn't want to let down. Whereas, you know, anyone can call themselves a promoter and book a room above a pub for nothing and, you know, rely on just getting the room for, you know, bar takings type of thing, can't they? So, yeah.
What do you think are the most underused features of a membership of Equity for a comedian?
Go ahead with that one.
Well, we have all these sort of on the services side. There are things that I think we do that probably would benefit comedians, but so we have our free training resources, which are all about business skills, and comedians absolutely run themselves as small businesses.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I think they're a fascinating artistic type, if you like, because not only do we create their own work, write their own stuff, observe everything, get their own gigs, travel, you know, do all the tax, the whole lot. They have to do everything in ways that certain other performers don't. So we do a lot of free business skills training. It's the website's feutraining.org, Federation of Entertainment Unions, because we do it collectively with the Musicians Union and the Writers Guild and the NUJ, National Union of Journalists. The government pays for it, so why would we not have everybody using it?
So it's not just a membership thing?
You have to be a member, belong to one of those unions.
Right.
And we pull together because musicians, comedians have in common a business skills need.
Mm.
So there's no point each union reinventing investing when we can do it collectively. So there's stuff on there about how pitching, negotiating, using social media for your work, not just your mates, building websites, channeling people to your website. How do you do that? Because just, you know, having one sitting in space is no use to anybody if people aren't looking at it. Tax returns, business planning, goal setting, all of this stuff. And it's all completely free. A lot of it's online through things like webinars. It's aimed very much at freelancers. So it recognises the fact that freelancers, when they're not working, have lots of time but no money. Mm-hmm. So they don't have time to pay for training. They don't have money to pay for training or spend their resources in that way. There are e-courses. There are actual get-together-in-a-room courses, but they're all short. There's nothing longer than a day. So it's very flexible and it's completely free. So we would say that's something that's underused, perhaps by comedians, that they don't know much about that one. We've mentioned the public liability insurance, which I think most comedians do know about, but we also insure all our members for accident. So on the premise that if I break my leg, I have a job. So I'm still going to be able to work. I'm still going to get a salary. Whereas most performers who have to go on stage tend not to be able to do that with a broken leg. The accident insurance pays out while people are getting better. So it's something like £152 a week for up to 12 months, for example. So that's one that people don't really know about, I think. They don't use enough.
Does that make the cost of your membership the next year go up, like a premium type thing with insurance, or is that?
No, our members set the fees. Every year we have an annual conference, and at that conference there will be about 200 people who are all representatives of branches, committees, our democratic structures, if you like. Usually there is a proposal about the fees. I think the last time it went up by £2 a year, something like that. They're never going to be huge increases. They never are.
And it's never going to be down to the individual's subscription to go up because they've made a claim. There's no claims bonus effect type of thing.
No, that's a very good point. So what else don't people
I think
use?
People could try to get along to a network meeting as well. I think they could probably be better advertised, because what the network have done now is they've set meetings for every month this year, apart from August, obviously, because everybody's away doing something somewhere. Yeah, I think we will try to publicise them more, and people should come along, because we've just had one this week. There's sort of one every month, as I've said, apart from August and December.
Yeah, and they are the opportunity for professional, you know, comedians to come in to the room, sit down, talk about what's going on, raise issues, come up with solutions, come up with ideas, you know. That's the point of
it. Why wouldn't there be one in August in Edinburgh?
Well, there might be.
There might be.
Oh,
we have done.
There won't be one here. We have done them the last couple of years.
We have done things in Edinburgh for comedians. And to be honest, they've not had a huge turnout, which you think they would, but then you have to stand back a bit and look at what is going on in Edinburgh, and everybody's rushing around. If they're not on stage, they're desperately trying to get people to come to their show, the flyering, the process, the press, everything. It's just, terribly difficult for people to go, actually, I will now take 2 hours or an hour out of this, you know, shift my focus.
Mm.
And so we found that actually quite challenging.
So the first one we had, probably 2016, I think, and we probably got about 20 people there, which considering how many comedians there are in Edinburgh that month. But some people say, well, you shouldn't hold it in the afternoon, you shouldn't hold it in the morning, hold it in the evening. Yeah, well, when do you hold it?
Yeah,
well, it's no time's ever going to suit everybody. So we did our best.
And we've tried different times and we've tried different venues, but they're all, it's absolutely bang central Edinburgh venues. I'm not saying come out to Leith or anything. So, you know, we try to make it as easy as possible, but I just think people are just too wrapped up in Edinburgh and the festival and everything that goes with it, and that's entirely understandable.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say busy, and I was going to say they're not busy, they're just wrapped up in their own ego for that month.
They're either asleep.
Or sleeping. We quite encourage that people should get some sleep during Edinburgh.
Because
we do quite a lot of work around mental well-being. And actually at Edinburgh, one of the things that comedians do come to is our sanctuary space, which we run, which is a we run it with the Fringe Society, and it is a completely quiet, silent space with a massage therapist and beanbags and just nothing to do with nothing to do with Edinburgh at all. So we don't let people, you know, use a mobile phone or do any of that stuff in there. It's a real curl up and just take complete time out and defrazzle a bit, because people get very wound up at Edinburgh and very stressed and very tired.
It's an understatement, yeah.
and we do have people who say, so, you know, what's your accommodation? They're like, they say, well, I'm sharing. I go, and then you dig a little bit deeper. And what they mean is that they've got the bed from 10 till 4, and then somebody else has it from 5 till, and it's like, that sort of sharing. So actually, the chance to just lie down somewhere, the blanket over you, and just chill out for a couple of hours has become quite important. So the sanctuaries, we do get a lot of comedians into the sanctuary.
No, I had a couple of friends last year that were renting either side of a bed to make it work, and it's crazy. But it's a buyer's market. I mean, it's a pay-to-play festival.
Like,
I think that's something they don't advertise well enough, because I think everyone thinks, oh, it's this amazing arts festival, and it is, but it's also a pay-to-play thing.
Yeah, effectively, the artists are paying for it, aren't they?
Yeah.
Really. But there has been a movement that we shouldn't interfere with that's as it is, and Edinburgh's one of those things we shouldn't try to change anything, because I think it was probably about 5 years ago that we got a low pay, no pay organiser, a specific person that was dealing with the subject of no pay. There was concern then, well, are they going to stop Edinburgh? Because there was even stories in the Stage about, you know, that if everybody had to get paid, Edinburgh just couldn't go ahead. Well, people seem to want it to go ahead. So there's never been any movement to try to kill it off. I mean, ideally, people would get paid properly. It wouldn't be one of those things that is effectively subsidised by the artists. It seems the balance is even more wrong than when it started.
Are you talking about spots on shows? Are you talking about the actual show itself?
Well, by the time you have to get up there, get accommodation, and then say if you were getting money from collection in buckets or that sort of thing, and if you're paying for promotional material and all those sorts of things, getting flyers handed out, you're going to come away having made a massive loss, which is people choose to do that in the hope that their show might get picked up and they'll get a massive amount of work out of some people have, you know. So people see that somebody has started an amazing career having done their show in Edinburgh. That's effectively what people do. They're paying to go to a trade show, show their wares to people in the hope that it'll go somewhere, and it can happen. So all the while that's a possibility, I think people seem to be happy to go ahead with it. But a lot of people are saying, oh, I just can't afford to do it this year, you know.
It's interesting because we were going to get onto your stances on pay-to-play gigs and free gigs and charity gigs. It was in 2017 you guys put out something basically, not having a go at, but saying if you're going to be doing a gig at a professional level, or if the promoter's getting paid, you should be getting paid.
Yeah.
And I think there was a lot of misinformation floating around about that, because a few people told me varying things at the time, and it sort of confused me, where I was a bit like, well, the open mic circuit is perfect for people who've never done a gig before. Yeah. Why should they be paid for their first gig? Because they're probably not going to be very good in the nicest way possible.
Yes.
And also, I don't think anyone's getting paid. You know, like the promoters are getting paid. The bar might be making money on a tab.
Yeah.
But that isn't, I don't think that's necessarily always going to cover the fees. So maybe it would be good to talk about the differences you've got when you're talking about pay for comedians for gigs they're doing, or even open spot progression things, because some comedians do unpaid tens at clubs in order to show what they can do to get work down the line. And where do you guys stand on that? And what are you trying to do with the industry within it?
Okay, well, we're absolutely fine with the free spot within a paid bill that people use to get their feet into comedy, basically. That's all fine. Nobody disagrees with that. What they don't want is for that it to become the norm that they should be doing a gig and not getting paid. That's the thing. As long as it is progression, everybody's happy with it. I mean, I would remember going to see comedy where there's free spots sort of, you know, 25 years ago or more. It was quite common that you'd have a paid lineup and then they would say, oh, this is next 5 minutes is somebody who's got a new act, you know, be nice to them, sort of thing. And then later you'd see them somewhere good, like Jonglers, being paid a good fee because they've developed their act. So that's fine. And comedians are also happy to go somewhere where they can try out new material and don't necessarily want to be paid massively for that, because they see that as part of, you know, trying out their own jokes, and it's as much for them as for the audience. But what our network don't like is bringers, for example. They're not mad on that, where people have to bring along a certain number of people to a gig who've paid for a ticket.
Okay, so you're okay if it's a free show and you have to bring a friend, but if they had to pay for a ticket to come along?
Well, sometimes they have to, you know, sell so many tickets at such and such a price.
Oh, no, I'm just distinguishing between, because there are some bringers in London which say you have to bring one friend, but it's free entry, and then there are some that go, bring a friend, it's £5 for it, or whatever it is for a ticket.
Yeah, well, I think bringer gigs in general are not...
So both those you're approved, not on board with, okay.
I think the model they would like is total transparency. You're paid a fee to do your job, or it's a free trial progression spot within a paid lineup, and that the punters are paying to get in. I think they prefer a ticketed audience to a free audience.
I mean, with bringers, I mean, eventually you're going to run out of friends.
I have.
Yeah. Well, you are. You're not going to be able, and if part of the position route path that gets you onto that stage to perform is you have to bring a load of people with you, and you've run out of people to bring, you can't perform. So it is just so flawed in every possible way. You know, it's like...
You'd hope by that, by you know, the point of, let's say, a year of doing... I mean, I don't think anyone would ever do bringers every night of the week for a year, but let's say you did one a month for a year. You'd hope by that point you would have progressed to a stage where you would do gigs that weren't bringers.
But I think that's...
I'm not defending them.
I think the concern is that things are changing, so that actually that progression is not really happening, and people are just being asked to keep bringing and keep bringing, no matter how many gigs they've done or what stage time they've got under the belt or whatever.
Yeah.
Because there are some promoters who just see this as a really easy way.
And it's also seen as discriminatory as well, because the sort of people that are going to be able to bring people are likely to be those sort of young single people, those who haven't got caring responsibilities, children, etc. They're not going to be the ones who are going to be able to find people to bring along. They haven't got a massive friends network. Once you get into that position of having a family or caring responsibilities, it's going to be harder for you to get your mates to come to a gig, isn't it? Because you're doing different things in your life at that stage.
Yeah.
So it mainly suits the younger, freer,
lonely.
Yeah. So person who's still living at home.
I'm not.
Yeah.
Me is what you're saying.
Yeah.
But it does throw out all those sort of wider ramifications and problems, really. Yeah, but progression is great. Getting, you know, as Mike was saying, spots to try out, to develop, first time on the stage, second time on the stage, all of those things go from 5 minutes to 10 minutes, build. Start getting paid at a point where you've built and you are progressing. Otherwise, you're not really progressing.
Yeah,
there comes a point where you stop progressing and you're just being exploited.
Totally, yeah, I understand.
And the sacred thing also is the Friday and Saturday nights, where they would expect to get a proper fee. You know, if you're doing Tuesday night or something, that might be more of a time to try out your new material. Rather, you don't want to be doing that for nothing on a Friday or Saturday.
No,
so that's of course. So yeah, as long as I mean, we've got people on our Comedians Network who've never done a gig other than been paid a guaranteed reasonable fee, because they've been, you know, they started in the 80s or whatever when the circuit was new, and they've stuck with it. And then we've got the other end of the scale, people who haven't yet done their first proper paid spot. You know, it's always been a bringer or a bucket collection or something like that. Nobody said to them, we're going to give you this fee to be a comedian on the night.
Without asking your peers, how do we know if we're getting paid a reasonable amount? Because if you've never got paid before,
yeah,
20 quid all of a sudden seems, oh, that's amazing. But it might be that every other act that month got 50 quid or something. You know, like how do you know that you're not being...
I think you can look at the economics of the actual gig to know how big the room is, whether tickets are being sold for a certain amount, or you can see lots of money being put in a bucket, lots of notes rather than coins at the end of the night, and you can see whether people are drinking a lot, and you can sort of imagine whether you're being ripped off or not.
Yeah, but you won't know until you're there, and by that point with the contract it would have been sorted. So yeah. I'm wondering if you guys advise, if you're the middle spot at this certain club, we know this is roughly what the pay is.
We do have difficulty with that because there's an organisation called the Competition and Markets Authority which prevents us from telling people what they should expect to get.
Okay.
Because that's like a rate fixing. Because if you think of each comedian is effectively their own business, it would be like businesses colluding to charge a minimum rate. So we're restricted by that. It would be great to be able to say that. We could only say that if we had an agreement with a group of clubs, say that there was a minimum rate for these different slot, the MC and the opener, closer, all those sorts of things. If we had an agreement with a group that we could do that, then we could advertise that, and that would then be the rate. Some people wouldn't like that because they think that minimum rate would become the rate, whereas they know they can negotiate more. So there's always been that argument within the whole of the variety entertainment sector, really. They don't want to have minimum rates because they know they can negotiate something better themselves, or they would hope they could in the future. They want to be able to name their own price, and that is their right.
You have equity minimum for actors, and I'm wondering if you have an equity minimum for open spot, for example, for comedians.
Yeah, that's why we can't do it. The reason we're able to have an equity contract for theatre is because there's a group of theatre managers. There's a Society of London's theatres that cover all the West End, and there's UK Theatre that cover the touring venue contract. And we negotiate with them annually on what the rates should be, minimum rates for weekly for actors. So we can do that with that group, and we do that within their recorded media, you know, with BBC and with the Independents. So we have those agreements in place. We need there to be another side that we can engage with, and it needs to be not just one club, it needs to be a significant employer, group of employers. So it is possible. I mean, if Jonglers had still been around, it could have been possible. Someone that's got loads and loads of clubs, that could be possible. We would have to then decide whether it's going to be worth us entering into that, whether it's going to make people better off or worse off. And if we thought it was going to make them better off, then we'd do it.
Hello. Interrupting the flow of the conversation to jump in and say that you might be about to hear a mid-roll advert. And if you are, you're one of the lucky ones, because not everyone's going to be able to hear an advert. And if you hear the advert, it's specially chosen just for you. That's right, whatever it is. If it's about foot fungal cream or your bad breath, we've picked that specifically and targeted you through the algorithm at Acast. You're very bloody welcome. I wonder what it'll be. Oh, it's like Christmas, this. You're not really sure what ad you're going to get, and you're not even sure if you're going to get one. You might have been horrible, and they might not want to give you an advert. Right, let's see if you do. Ready? Here we go.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound. and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Oh, that wasn't too painful, was it? That was all right. Just so you're aware, if you didn't get an advert, I didn't get paid. If you did get an advert, I probably got paid about 4p. So if you would like to get an episode of the podcast without any adverts in, you can become a Patreon from $1 an episode, which skips this middle bit and any ads on it. Please check out that link in the show notes. It would really, really help out the show and the future viability of this project. If you don't care about the future viability of the project, or you just don't have the money to support it, either way, perfectly reasonable, then just carry on with your life. If you don't have money right now, but you do want to come support me at some point, I'm doing a load of festivals and shows around the country with my new 2019 show, Every Room Becomes a Panic Room When You Overthink Enough. There's a link in the show notes that will tell you where I'm going to be. Check it out. That'd be really helpful. And if you're going to be at the Edinburgh Festival, book a ticket, please. I'm going to be there for the entire month, and I am really proud of this show, but that's not relevant for right now. I'm not here to tell you how good the show is. I'm just here to tell you that it exists, because that's how I market my shows. It is bloody good, but you don't want to hear that. You want to get back into the episode. I totally understand. Let's jump back in.
I got a message from a friend of mine who was an actor and now largely does comedy, and he was talking about how it was easier for an actor to join and receive benefits associated with membership than he felt it is when he became a comic. Yeah. And I wondered if you had anything to say on the difference between joining of those two things, whether it is actually sort of segmented internally for you guys, as you know, you join as an actor, you join as a comedian, you join us, because obviously often those things, Venn diagram overlap.
Shall I start a bit on that one?
Yeah.
I think up until, I think it was about 3 years ago, there was something like 72 different paths in to joining Equity, depending on what you did. But that was just not manageable for anybody, for us, for people to understand it, for anything. So it is actually the same criteria now applies to everybody, no matter what they do or where they come from. They need to be able to show us that they've earned £500 or more from the entertainment industry. So as a performer, as a director, as a singer, as a stand-up comedian, as a juggler, as whatever it might be that they do. But it's that financial benchmark rather than show me the contracts from that particular sector, or show me what you've got from here. And when we say what we want, that they need to show us what they've got, that's contracts, pay slips, invoices, any, even bank statements that shows who's paid you, but just to show that you've earned that. And it's not one contract, it can be any number that add up to £500 or more. So we've made it more straightforward, and in that, I think we've sort of equaled out any differences that might have been there, real or perceived, I think. And then once somebody's in, a card is a card is a card. So we don't say you've joined as a comedian, therefore you can only work in comedy, or we only ever think of you as a comedian. You know, we have lots of people who've come in through one route and then do all sorts of other things. Comedian talking at an event we did on Tuesday, who describes herself as a comedian, a storyteller, a writer, a director, and all of those things, but it's only one Equity card. You know, it covers you the whatever you're working in.
I will go, because I had another question submitted which said that they went to drama school and they found that you guys come into the school and have meetings with them before they leave, so they're aware of Equity, and that is very useful for them. But they said when they left and they became a comedian, they spoke to other people who do comedy courses, and you know, like for example Oliver Double, who runs something down in Kent which is like a more formalised university course. They don't get the same sort of outreach, and they were wondering what kind of outreach you do and what elements of that you think you need to improve on to kind of get your message out to us better.
Yeah, absolutely. We've done some work with the Comedy School in London.
I'm right, yeah.
Done some work with them around their events and things. I mean, it is...
You came to mine.
Came to yours.
Thank you for coming to that.
No, we will always go to where comedians are. I mean, the challenge is...
I'll be inviting you to the next one.
Please do, we'd love to come. But the challenge is comedians' workplaces. There's like two or three in a space, two or three comedians, four or five max in one night. So whereas if you're in a drama school, you've got everybody in the same space for a year. So it's much easier to schedule getting in to see them and talk to them. This is an excuse. We just do it differently. We do a lot of stuff at festivals. So the Leicester Comedy Festival, for example, we do lots there. We get round all the venues. We get round as many of the shows as we can without actually moving to Leicester for 2 weeks. We always do a big event at Leicester to really try and underpin that equity has a relationship and a role within comedy. So that's the we set up the ISAE annual comedy conversation, and we've done so we've had Alexis Sale, Nicholas Parsons, Barbara Nice, Sarah Pascoe, and this week and just gone Tom Allen did it for us. That's another way that we do about just trying to let comedians know that we are there for them and they can come to us. We do similar stuff at Edinburgh. We get around as many of the venues as we can. We talk to people. We do a lot of identifying, writing to, emailing to, that kind of stuff. But it is generally harder to get a group of comedians in one space than it is to get a group of actors, because actors work in ensemble. I mean, that's what we do. There's always a bunch of them. But we do try, and we are very much open to ideas and suggestions. We've done sort of odd team, not that we're odd teams, but odd nights where we've done teams round the comedy clubs in London. And then sort of choose a couple of nights, and okay, so two of us will go to a club and we just have a circuit that we get round, and we try and talk to the comedians as much as possible, which involves a lot of standing around the bar maybe, but that's Brighton's fine.
Brighton's another one we go to as well.
So we do try, but we are really always open to ideas and suggestions about how to get in. But with the university comedy courses, and I'm probably at fault here, my understanding of them is that they're more academic rather than practical.
Right.
They're not really, because we quite often get requests for research questions, and can you tell us about this, that and the other to deal with research projects that those students are doing, rather than it being about, here's a microphone, here's a stage, here's how you tailor an act, here's how you work out material, here's your running order, that, you know, the actual skills of comedy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm really happy to go and talk to, or get colleagues to go and talk to those courses.
Okay, and the Comedians Network are keen to engage with courses where they can as well. They thought about putting some video stuff together. Might be easier than trying to go there in person sometimes if they've got some messages they want to convey to the new people. So yeah, if there's significant courses, we'd definitely look at going. We've got enough people out there on the road to call in.
What do you think are the biggest areas of weakness for equity in relation to comedians?
I think the circuit is just so disparate in a way, really, and it's changed such a lot. And some of the things they say is that people are coming out of comedy schools with the skills to set up their own, or they're advised on how to set up their own nights and things. So it's just kind of spreading all over the place at the moment. Established clubs are better to work with than things that are just popping up all over the place. But it's definitely a challenge to, and to get people to complain as well, to get people to complain when things are going wrong. Yeah. I mean, we've just done a survey on late night safety and sexual harassment and that sort of thing. So that's probably going to be our next push now, to try to do something about that, because the survey did uncover quite a lot of stuff going on out there. So there's, you know, the car sharing type scenarios and, you know, inappropriate behaviour that goes on actually in the clubs themselves. Sometimes it's the promoter, sometimes it's other comedians, sometimes it's the audience, and about trying to do more to protect and create a safe environment. So we were going to try to draw up some additions to the contract to have some kind of charter for venues to sign up to protect.
We were very interested in the work that Samina Zira and Zera and Seymour Mace did. That testimony stuff.
Oh, you're at that.
That is really interesting to us for this sector, and will probably help as well impact on some of the things that we're talking about in that sort of guidelines, code of conduct, whatever we want to call it.
So, like, for reference for the listener, that was an event that was done in Edinburgh this year called Tales of the Unacceptable. I have spoken to them this year, and if we're doing another one, I'm going to record that and put that as a podcast. Brilliant. Probably with a few names beeped, just because I imagine that I'll get a libelly sued. But yeah, it was an amazing event, and I don't think I was fully prepared going into it, because there was a lot of people giving their experiences in not necessarily graphic detail, but a lot of detail, and I knew a lot of them. And so it made me feel very uncomfortable, in the sense that they hadn't come forward up to this point because they didn't feel like they could. And especially, you know, what was it, week three of Edinburgh it was happening or something, it was sort of that time anyway where everyone's feeling a bit vulnerable, and it was Yeah, I feel like that should definitely be happening more, that sort of event.
We are running, a response to the Harvey Weinstein allegations, which are just over a year ago now. We did a lot of work, and out of that came our Agenda for Change report, which is sort of a blueprint for what we think the industry should be doing and changing. A lot of stuff has happened, a lot of stuff's changed. We have a Safe Spaces campaign out of that. We have a harassment phone number. Safe Spaces campaign is basically stating very clearly that a workspace is a safe space, and the harassment, bullying, this kind of poor behaviour simply will not be tolerated. Mm-hmm. That everybody involved in that project will not be a bystander. We will feel empowered to call it out, to raise it. We will be listened to. Mm-hmm. All these sorts of things. It's around dignity at work, really. Mm-hmm. I think we have a harassment helpline. We have a harassment email. And the thing is, again, I sometimes worry that, there is a perception that this is all about actors, and it's not. Mm. It's about anybody, any member who's facing any kind of bullying, harassment, discrimination, poor treatment. That's what unions do. That's what we're here for. So, get in touch, basically.
Yeah, as a comedian, I think it's media-led perception more than anything, because I don't have a day-to-day link with Equity. I don't talk to you on an overly regular basis. But when I see things on TV or on the newspapers and stuff, it's always really actors talking, and I think it comes down to one of the most interesting things I saw on your website, which again felt a little bit like it was geared towards actors, but that might be because I've just seen groups of actors getting together and then speaking out. And I feel like with comedians, like we talked about before, your big fear sometimes is you won't get booked, or you'll be seen as the problem maker, or you'll be seen as someone who isn't just playing ball with the status quo, or any of the, quite frankly, horrible excuses that we give for not speaking up. It's kind of odd, because what would happen, say, for example, I was told something and it's not my story. Can I put someone who's not a member in touch?
We're happy to hear from somebody who's not a member, to be honest, when it comes to things like this. But third-hand stories are a bit harder to deal with.
Of course. Because but I know there are a lot of new performers.
We want to hear from the actual person, yes. Mm. But we kind of want to know what's going on. We want people to talk to us about seemingly insignificant or things that don't cross the line on legality, things that are just offensive, sexist, racist, but not sufficient enough that the police would be interested. Because sometimes the advice is you've got to get the police involved. But people can talk to us confidentially, tell us things that are going on. With a non-member, we're not going to be able to represent them. But if it builds up a case file against a particular person or organisation, there's going to be members that are going to want to complain as well. So ultimately we might be able to do something about that.
Yeah, because it's one of those weird ones where, like you said, a lot of the stuff that's happening legally is so ambiguous that I can imagine that makes your job a bit of a nightmare, because the reflection on your end could be, well, you're not doing anything, but the reality is the law can't necessarily dictate over certain acts or certain things that maybe it should. But also maybe it can't, just because of the grey area of the arts being what it is. Yeah. So maybe are you lobbying for change in that area? What's happening?
Sometimes it's not necessarily about the law. Sometimes it's workplaces, whatever the workplace, should have policy in place, which is not necessarily the law, but it is about what we in this building, in this club, in this venue expect. This is how we expect people to treat each other. This is how we expect people to behave. So there should be some of those policies. There are things that can be done under health and safety law, duty of care to people who are in your building, in your space, in your club, whatever, who you're working with. So there are lots of ways of approaching this rather than just say it's assault. It's within, covered by sexual misdemeanor legislation or whatever it might be. There are lots of different ways of approaching it, and we will use all of them.
Well, let's, because again, I think the path after reporting something is what I think people get scared of sometimes, because they're not sure where their information is going to be used or where their words are going to be passed on to and what's happening. So let's role play, if we're like, let's say someone called up and wanted to report something that was let's say a sexual offence. Where's that information going to go? What's the process, and how are they dealt with?
Yeah, so it could be reported on our sexual harassment line, our dedicated helpline, for example. The person there would refer it to the organiser, could be someone like myself, if it's my area. So if it's a London kind of non-theatre type workplace, then that would come to me. And then we would have to talk to that person to find out what to do next, depending on the case. It could be, if it's serious enough, it could be that they have to go to the police about it. It could be something that we take up, if they want us to, take up with the promoter or the club or potentially the other artist. But really, it's the employer that we're looking to do something about this. So it's just going to be on a case-by-case basis, really. So it's either a police matter or an industrial matter. They may not want to do anything. They may just want to talk to somebody about it, which is often the case. So you know, that might be good enough, that they don't want a definite outcome out of it. They just want to tell somebody that it's happened, and they want to say it in confidence and leave it at that, really.
We're always led, really, by what the member wants. You know, it's their situation, so we will support, we will help, we will represent, advise. We will advise, we will do all sorts of things, but we can't force somebody to go to the police, can't force somebody to, and nor would we out them, if you like, without their, you know, express consent that they want us to go and then talk to the employer, or they want us to talk to the other artist, or they want us to talk to the agent or the casting person or you know, the TV exec or whoever it is that they feel they've got, you know, this difficulty with. But we don't just go off and do that without their full consent, knowledge and a bit of a plan, about what's going to be said, what we want to do, what they, you know, and what they want out of it. Because, you know, sometimes it's, I can't work in this space anymore, I need to be got out of the contract, I need to be got out. You know, that's okay, we can manage that out. It might be, I want an apology. That can be organised. It might be, I don't want anything, I just wanted to say it out loud to somebody who would believe me.
Be heard, yeah.
Or listen to me. Or, you know, or not laugh at me, or not dismiss me, or not devalue me, or those sorts of things. I mean, you know, it's very much, or make excuses, it's very much around what that individual particularly wants or needs.
And I assume that if they called up, were open about who they are, what happened, and said, I would like to take it further, but I don't want my name being included, does that damage what you can do, or the case taken forward? Like, where does that put you?
Definitely a limit to what you can do with an anonymous type complaint. I mean, you can't go to court. I mean, if you're owed money, for example, you can't go to court as a anonymous person. You have to put your name forward. So we would have to work out with them whether we can talk to the employer without them being able to identify that person. So that could be the plan. If they're seeing enough people and they're not going to be able to work it out, if they're going to be able to work it out, it's pointless being anonymous, isn't it?
So
I mean, that is difficult. If the particular promoter doesn't book that many women and it's a woman complaining and it's fairly soon after the event, they're going to struggle to do it anonymously. But it's unlikely to be something that's going to be able to go to court anyway, that sort of behaviour. It's either a police matter, a criminal matter. There isn't really necessarily a breach of contract angle that you can claim financial damages for to go to the county court. So,
Say there is a promoter, although it almost certainly is, but say there was a promoter who is doing something like that, and they come forward and obviously that promoter is never going to book that act again if they know who that person is. But then, like you say, they might not want to work with them again.
Won't want to work with them. Yeah.
Are they just allowed to keep promoting? Like, is there a list of promoters that have had strikes against them that you guys have publicly that means people know who to avoid?
We can't put anybody on our, as called, a court judgments list. It used to be called a for your special attention list. We used to be able to put people on a list that we would advise that you didn't work for, or that you contacted Equity before working for. And we could pretty much put somebody on that list for lots of reasons, for bullying and things like that. Now we've been told by the Information Commissioner's Office, you know, the data protection people, that we can only put somebody on if we've got a court judgment against them, because that's a fact.
Right.
Okay. It's not contestable in any way. It's you know, a plain fact. That is the limit. That's the only time we can put somebody on that list. You know, informally we might be able to address a direct inquiry, but we certainly can't publish anything about somebody, we've been told, unless we've got to the judgment stage.
I suppose there's a a gap there between legality and like you said, because some of these things can't be dealt with legally. Yeah. So if you can't deal with it legally, they can't go to court, which means they can't be on a list. And it sort of feels like that gap or loophole even is helping cause problems.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely a gap there. Yeah. That's a situation that we probably have to talk to the promoter about rather than actually look at legal action. And we certainly couldn't publish details.
Right. Could, like you said, Samina and Seymour are doing, I'm not going to say they are going to do something like this, but they're out there doing stuff, and I think it's fair to name them on the, I'll message them before to make sure they're okay with their name being in it. But if comedians wanted to have a list of people, would you get involved and be like, well, hang on, that's not allowed?
We might talk about whether we could get legal advice on what's allowed, you know.
Because it could be that the promoter libels you then for saying, I've never been legally prosecuted.
Yeah, you would be opening yourself up for libel if you printed anything.
It's kind of a frustrating...
It's massively frustrating, but I mean, sort of the basic rule of thumb is don't name people unless you are prepared to actually take that forward as a proper claim and a proper case. That's probably... really, because as you were saying, you were thinking earlier on in this conversation, you were sort of saying you might bleep some names out. That's part of it. So walking around saying X is this based on hearsay rather than saying X did this to me, I've got records of it, I've got dates, I've got times, there were other people around whose names I can come up with, you know, it was this place, it was this time, and I want to take that as an actual complaint forward, then you know, it's best not to name them.
I think there's everything on the Me Too stuff. I'm not quite sure how to...
No, I mean, our message about the Me Too stuff is basically it's always going to be case by case because these things are very personal. I mean, that's you know, the very nature of whether they're casual sexism or casual harassment, if that's even a thing, it still feels very, completely, very personal. So members are facing any of those kind of difficulties, we would just say get in touch and we will listen and we will talk and we will work out whatever it is that is going to be best for that person.
Would it be, as we were talking before about banding together and having like a group of people and that sort of event, would it be more helpful for you if someone who, and by the way, I'm not just off the top of my head here, thinking if someone had an experience with someone within the industry and they found out other people had a similar thing, would it be better for them to say, me and 10 other people have this thing they want to talk to you about? Would that be a stronger case? Even if it's not something legally that could be pursued, would that enable you to act or shut down their gig or whatever it is?
Yeah, it would be interesting to try something on that base if you've got enough people, because certainly... with the Weinstein thing, it wasn't because it was one complaint.
It was because
people were coming up from all over the place saying it happened to me as well. You know, exactly the whole Me Too thing. So, yes, I think it would strengthen the case and possibly increase the chances of action. So, yes, but exactly what action is difficult to say hypothetically, what is possible.
What's the telephone number, just for the reference of people at home?
0207 670 0268.
Okay, and you can ring that if you're not a member as well, just if you want to report stuff.
As Mike said, we can't represent and we can't... But yeah, there are other helplines that the industry have put together. There's one that the cinema... I've forgotten what it's called now. It used to be... It's one of the charities that used to work specifically with cinema and film and TV workers. They have a helpline that anybody can phone who works in the industry, and theatre... employers have also put one together, which again, anyone can phone from any sector of the industry. And just because they're called theatre or film or cinema doesn't preclude.
Mm.
It basically means live performance and recorded performance. That's really what it comes down to. So yeah, those are out there as well.
Well, if I'll email you, in the podcast notes, there'll be links to all these things but I think it's worth, just because we had this sort of chat about it, so people know they can talk up if they want to, and you are willing to listen even if they're not a member.
We have had some successes at with sexual harassment at tribunal level. Mm. We certainly have, where people have come forward and it has not harmed their career. I think that's quite important to say.
That's very important to hear, yeah.
And successful outcomes, you know, so they are completely possible. We would just encourage people. I think the difference with the Weinstein thing is that an incredibly powerful person, because sexual harassment is all about power, and that's really what it is, an incredibly powerful person has, and it has been shown that they are facing consequences for their actions, and that's the difference. That's actually the sort of really crucial message, I think, that actually somebody that huge and powerful, who everyone thought was untouchable, is in fact not untouchable and will be facing, you know, challenge and consequences and all those sorts of things. And so the more people that come forward, the more people that raise these things, the more challenges to those sorts of bad power relationships will happen.
I've got a last few questions to ask you, but I'm just trying to think about a segue so that it's so it's a lighter series.
Let's get away from harassment, let's talk about something else.
So career advice. A few people have asked, who do they actually speak to when they call up about career advice? Is it a comedian? Is it one of you guys? Is it someone who's been sort of a veteran, like you said? Who was it? Alexi.
Right. So we have careers advisors who are performers and writers. We have two at the moment, Paul and Bev. I think they're mainly from an acting background, but they have done all sorts, basically. And people can book a one-to-one session with them. They are trained to the National Gold Matrix standard for delivering information, advice and guidance. And they know the industry inside out, and they're good on just all sorts of, you know, the peculiarities of the entertainment business rather than a normal standard careers advisor. Otherwise, people will phone the relevant organizer in the building. We call them organizers, so it's a person who has an area of responsibility. So like Micah's Variety, Light Entertainment, Cabaret Circus, for example. We have a BBC organizer, we have a film TV organizer, whatever. Quite often they'll come through to me, and I know quite a lot about all sorts of sectors and stuff, and we can signpost and direct and talk. We can do that. So no, they're not going to be speaking to somebody who doesn't have any grounding or understanding of the industry. That's not what it's about, really. It's about peer-to-peer, and it's about people who work and understand this very peculiar landscape in which we all operate.
And that's included in your membership? Oh, yeah. So it's not like a paid...
No, they can talk to me at any time. It's fine.
Okay, cool. Yeah, no, I understand the curiosity there, because as we briefly spoke about before the podcast started, anyone could start a comedy course. You know what I mean? And as a result, if you've never done comedy before, or you're not in the industry yet, you know, go to Squarespace, make a professional looking website in minutes, as they say, use my discount code, and you know, you're able to, you know, do something like that. And obviously you guys are much more professional than anyone who could just do that, but obviously I think it's worth people noting that you're not going to just be calling, you know, sort of someone who's never gigged before.
No. We've never been on stage, but we understand sort of the ins and outs of it and the ramifications and how you get to be on stage, those processes and things. But we do, again, at Edinburgh, for example, we always have a week of workshops and events and so on. But we also have a drop-in, which where anybody can just come in and find us or our colleagues from our Glasgow office, who also throughout the festival then have drop-in days in Edinburgh for people to come and ask advice and just bring your CV or ask, you know, whatever. I mean, they're all pretty well-versed. And we do a lot of that kind of outreach where we go to where people are and get them to talk to us about whatever it is they need to talk to us about. Drop-ins, from our perspective, drop-ins are great because we have no idea what's going to come at us. So that's really keeps you on your toes, and it's interesting, and sometimes it's really fascinating. But we've never so far, touch wood, had something that we haven't been able to help with or signpost onto or look into a bit more deeply. Okay.
And pensions is another thing on your website, which I think most comedians A, don't think about, and B, don't think is an option in this industry, because, you know, you're like you say, you're a freelance business essentially. And it talks a bit about how, you know, you can pay into it and that sort of stuff. So what do you offer in terms of a pension for a member?
Yeah, so the pension scheme's there, and it's very easy to register. It's just a case of making the one phone call and getting a number. Where it really benefits you is if you're working on one of the standard contracts in theatre or in television, because then the employer's put in money that you wouldn't otherwise have got. If you're just investing but you're not working for any of those employers, then you're just putting in your own money. There's nobody, no employer putting in some as well. Mm. I don't think it's possible to set up a scheme for promoters to put money into the pension scheme as employers just because of the nature of the contract.
Mm.
But people do go from comedy to work for the big employers. So, you know, for the sake of making a phone call and having a pension, they may as well do it. They may as well try and put some money into it.
Mm.
Because the sooner they do that, the more likely they are to see a return when they retire.
Mm.
So the longer it's been in there, the better.
Yeah, it's a pension scheme that has been designed to recognise the slightly up and down working life of our members. So it's not something you have to contribute to every month. So there's a lot more flexibility about when you put money into it. Obviously, if you can, that's marvellous, but you might not be able to. It's this hybrid between a personal pension and one that certain employers will pay into when you're working for them. So that makes it quite interesting. And other organisations have kind of tried to copy that model. So it is very much tailored around the up and down working patterns, lifestyles of performers. But yeah, I think Mike sort of explained quite well how it works. But if you are working, say, you know, on doing a comedy thing on Radio 4 or whatever, then this is a payment above your fee. So you get your fee and then they'll pay a bit more directly into your pension scheme. So why not? Because it costs nothing to get into it and you might as well have one, you know. Mm.
Names. Now, I know you historically you make sure everyone has a unique name.
We do, yeah.
Still do.
Yeah. A few people have said, well, let's say my name's John Smith. There's a fair number of ex-John Smiths on the circuit who maybe have built up a name for themselves, even though their name is not unique, if you like, and it might already be taken. How do you deal with that in terms of making sure that people who, you know, because if you, let's say you spent 8 to 10 years getting to a stage where you could join Equity because you have built that up and you've built a reputation, you might not want to change your stage name and compromise that because that's part of your brand and part of your business.
That's right.
How is that dealt with?
Well, I mean, some people do join under a slightly different name but continue to use the name that they've established because the name's already taken. A lot of high profile people you might have known have decided at that point just change the name, have something completely different, and that is of benefit to them. But we would still, if somebody was performing under one name but we knew them as something else, we would still represent them. But it can become difficult when there's royalties involved in when you're working on to make sure they send the money to the right person. It is ideal that you're consistent about the name that you use in your career. But I would say to anybody, don't let it stop you joining and having the other benefits. So you can make a subtle change to your name so that it's a unique Equity name. And then, you know, still keep on using the brand name that you've been using.
Yeah, we try to keep a record whenever possible of an actor name as well, don't we?
Yeah, so people have a legal name, an Equity name, and an ACT name within the records.
Within their membership records. So, you know, some people have their, I mean, quite often with drag acts and things, for example, they're not always, their Equity name is not always their drag act name.
Mm.
Yeah, and burlesque. And
burlesque
and
some of
things,
those sorts of places, and children's entertainers, you know. So, and some comedians, actually, when I think about it. Mm. But yeah, so we keep a record so we can try and identify, because as Mike says, a lot of this is about money. It's about royalties, it's about residuals, it's about making sure that the right person's getting the money. A lot of it is about brand recognition, and some of it's around not getting yourself into trouble for passing off where people think you're going out under their name and therefore you are taking their work because people are booking you because they think you're the other person. You know, and that can get very messy.
No, completely.
So unique names are good if at all possible.
Definitely. Last question. If you had one bit of advice for a non-Equity member who has never considered joining but would like to, what would you say to them?
Well, it's hard not to say come and join us, come and get involved, because until you do, you won't know what you're missing effectively. You may think you're paying out a certain amount a year for a bit of insurance and a bit of, you know, help if you need it, but actually meeting other members doing the same thing as you can be a very good thing, because particularly on the circuit, you might not see that many people.
Yeah.
You know, you might be very alone. Whereas if you come to a room and there's 20 people, for example, you might get more out of that. Mm. You might learn more from that than you do in a year on your own. Mm. So, yeah, come and get involved.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're obviously going to say it's a good thing. And we were, you know, obviously, you know, some people say I can't afford it. And we'd probably say, well, the answer to that is you probably can't afford not to. Because in terms of money, it's, most people do it direct debit. It's just over £10 a month. That's what it works out at, which is, you know, 2.5 coffees, something like that, a month. Mm. And this is a slightly more lasting effect. I don't know. It is a bit of a community. It is... I think there is a relief if you are experiencing something that you know someone's got your back, that you know you can phone up, then they will understand what on earth it is you are talking about. Mm. So, you know, we get people from other sectors who use the most extraordinary props and start phoning us up and talking about sort of fire props and all kinds of things. And we actually know what they're on about, and they find that quite reassuring and helpful. So we sort of understand... the world, we understand the pressures, we understand the very peculiar nature of working in the entertainment industry, where you're a freelance, where you're traveling a lot, where you're working at night when nobody else is, the pressure that puts on relationships, the pressure it puts on your finances. We do sort of get it, and that's quite a big part of why people want to be, you know, involved, really.
Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
That was Michael and Louise. Oh, I loved hearing about the future of equity, how they're trying to successfully flush out guilty parties within the industry without negatively impacting the careers of the victims. I put some links in the show notes that Louise gave me for places that you can go if you would like to voice something that's happened to you within the industry, or you would like to speak out or have yourself be heard about anything within the Me Too movement that you would like to be taken seriously and maybe even progress that into a legal sense. So if you want to check out those links, please do. Please do speak out if you can, because it's how things change, and that's really important. And I loved hearing about what I'm paying for with equity. I loved hearing about the future of the organization. I loved hearing about, like, literally just what they don't do, because I've never bothered asking them what they don't do, which gives me a better understanding of what they do. And so I now know when I email them for stuff that I'm not, you know, like, I'm not going to annoy them in that way. That was really exciting. A little exclusive for you for making it this far into the episode. I am working with Equity to do another festival meet and greet at the Edinburgh Festival. Keep your eyes out for that. If you want the most up-to-date information on that event, please join the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on bloody Facebook, isn't it? So, yeah, if you do that, then you'll find out who's going to be on it and what we're doing and where. It's, yeah, it's exciting, and I'm looking forward to it. After you join the Facebook group, join our Patreon. You can do it from $1 an episode. Oh, that's 80p. It's a freaking bargain, mate. If you can support the podcast from 80p, you get these episodes ad-free. You also get emails ahead of time, ahead of the Facebook group, to let you know when we're going to be doing live meetups and industry events. And if you can't do that, but you want to donate something, you can do that on PayPal, which is on my website, simonkane.co.uk. If you can't afford anything right now, that's perfectly understandable. Give us a review. Ideally 5 stars, but if not, a 4-star that reads like a 5-star will be just as good. Everything and any support is really appreciated. The Ask the Industry Podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening, thank you very much for subscribing, and thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.